The Civil Rights Movement. The Civil Rights Movement, although famously involving mass public demonstrations and sit-ins and various other kinds of activity, voter registration drives, and various other kinds of activity, was primarily a legal and ultimately a constitutional dispute. It had its precursors in some Supreme Court cases of the 1940s, first of which, Smith versus Allwright, involved the political structure of segregation in the South. This was a case involving membership in the Democratic Party in the state of Texas. Texas Democrats claimed that because their party was a private institution, they could exclude people from it on whatever ground they chose, and just coincidentally, they'd been excluding people from the Democratic Party on the basis of being black. In 1944, the Supreme Court took this case, and ultimately it decided that Democrats in Texas had to allow black people to vote in their primaries. They said that this organization, the Democratic Party, was, because of the function it filled in Texas, not entirely private, not really private, but that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment did extend to the Democratic Party's primary elections. Secondly, in 1948, the court decided another significant precursor case to the Civil Rights Movement, and that was Shelley versus Kramer. The issue there was what exactly it meant to say in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment that no state could deprive any person of equal protection of the laws, because Shelley versus Kramer was a case about what were called restrictive covenants. A restrictive covenant, actually there still are some kinds of restrictive covenants. A restrictive covenant is an agreement among neighbors, in this case, not to sell their property to particular classes of people. So historically in America, there have been restrictive covenants excluding Catholics, excluding Jews, and in this case, excluding black people from particular neighborhoods. And the argument that the counsel for the person who wanted to sell this property with the restrictive covenant made was that, well, there really wasn't any state action here. Again, the Equal Protection Clause says that no state may deprive any person of the equal protection of the laws, and what had happened here was that one private individual had made a contract with another private individual. Where was the state in this? The Supreme Court decided that Shelley versus Kramer decided that restrictive covenants did involve state action because it was the state's courts that were enforcing the covenant. Of course, this might appeal to our sense of justice, but the problem is that anytime you have any kind of private agreement, ultimately you could have the state enforcing it. And if we're going to say that anytime the state enforces an agreement, it's not private, that doesn't leave any space for anything to be private. We're used to private individuals being allowed to discriminate in ways that we don't allow the government to discriminate. So, for example, there are many college scholarships for which only women or blacks or Catholics or Jews or Republicans or you name it are allowed to apply. If the state government were to discriminate in this way and say we're going to have X contest and only Jews may apply or only Jews may not apply or something like that, then we'd say, well, this violates the Equal Protection Clause. In Shelley versus Kramer, what the court did was to extend the rubric of state action to what really amounted to a private kind of covenant. But apparently what had happened here was just that the court decided it found these restrictive covenants too noxious to be allowed to continue to exist, and so it got into the business of declaring there to be state action where there wasn't. Notice what the court was doing here was, by saying that there was state action, giving itself a veto over these private contracts because it found them immoral or unpalatable. And we're going to see that there is going to be more of this kind of behavior by federal judges in related cases when the actual civil rights movement began. Of course, the most important 20th century court decision regarding the question of racial discrimination was Brown versus Board of Education 1, which was decided in 1954. Now, I make a distinction between Brown 1 and Brown 2 because, yes, there were two Brown versus Board of Education decisions. The first one involved segregation in five jurisdictions all over the country. So what the court did was that it took appeals of five cases involving segregation in primary and secondary schools from different parts of the country. The name defendant was the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, and it wasn't an accident that that was the name defendant. Although racial segregation in schools was primarily a Southern phenomenon, the judges on the Supreme Court had the idea that a ruling against racial segregation would work better if it didn't seem that what the court was doing was targeting the South. And so the cases that were consolidated here were from Virginia, South Carolina, Delaware, the District of Columbia, and Kansas. You can see a kind of northeastern state, a midwestern or a central plains state, a deep South state, an upper South state, and the federal capital district. The plaintiffs in the case staked an equal protection clause claim. They said that the 14th Amendment, Section 1's statement that no state can deprive any person of the equal protection of the laws meant that there couldn't be racial segregation in schools. Now, this seems a truism to us today, living as we do 59 years as I'm speaking after Brown versus Board of Education, but it wasn't a truism at the time. In fact, it's constitutionally dubious. One of the justices on the court, perhaps the leading intellectual light on the court, Justice Felix Frankfurter, assigned his law clerk, that is his legal assistant, Alexander Bickel, task of doing research on the question what the original understanding of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause in regard to segregation of schools was. Frankfurter evidently hoped that Bickel would come back from this project with evidence that there was nothing new about the court's claim that the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause banned segregation of schools. But Bickel, who later would be a very prominent law professor at the Yale Law School, came to the opposite conclusion. In fact, he posited evidence that not only was segregation of schools not contrary to the Equal Protection Clause, but the very Congress that passed the 14th Amendment also established segregated schools in the District of Columbia. Besides that, there have been segregated schools in Boston, which was the center of the movement in America for black rights. In any event, both Bickel and Frankfurter were disappointed in that. So when the court handed down its decision in the case, Brown won in 1954, Chief Justice Earl Warren addressed this question indirectly, and what he said was, "We," meaning the Supreme Court, "we cannot go back to, we cannot be bound by the understanding that people had of the Equal Protection Clause in 1868." Notice, another way of putting that is we can't be bound by law. We can't be bound by the intention of the people who made this legal provision binding on the American people. Instead, what Warren had decided and what he and his fellow justices had decided was that they were more moral, they had a better idea than the lawgivers had had in 1868. Now, of course, the point here isn't to dispute that racial segregation of schools was a noxious tradition in the South and much of the rest of the United States. And as I recall, there were 17 states, not just the 11 Confederate states, there were 17 states and the District of Columbia that had segregation either in some of their schools or in all their schools. The issue here isn't whether that was a noxious practice, but what kind of government the United States is supposed to have. Is it supposed to be a government by self-appointed wise people who are just smarter than the rest of us so that we can have our periodic Republican elections. But whatever the results of those may be, they're really smart people, quote unquote, really smart. And how do we know they're really smart? Well, they're on the Supreme Court and they say so. And how do they know they are? Well, they just say so. This is highly problematic. Besides the fact that the court said it couldn't be bound by the understanding of 1868, it also dropped what was and remains the second most famous footnote in the history of American law, and that was the footnote citing studies by Kenneth Clark using dolls into the psychological effect of segregation on students. What Clark did was that he took dolls, one that was patterned to resemble an African descended person, and one that was supposed to resemble a Caucasian person, and he showed them to black students who had grown up in segregation and asked them which of them they liked better. And a large majority of the black students who had grown up in segregation in this test liked the white doll better. From that, Clark concluded that, well, it must be that segregation has a highly negative influence on the psychological makeup of people who have been brought up in this practice, because how else could you explain that the black kids were saying they thought the white doll was prettier or nicer or had various good qualities that the black doll didn't have? Now, one difficulty that came up later, that is after the court had ruled here, was that when this same test was replicated among students who had gone to school in the Detroit schools, where there never had been legal segregation, a higher portion of them said they preferred the white doll than said they preferred the black doll in the South. How do we account for that? If Clark's test proved anything, and it's hard to conclude that it did, but if it proved anything, it would have been the opposite of what Clark was claiming that it proved. In any event, when the court finished reading this opinion, when Warren finished reading this opinion from the bench, apparently several of the justices were weeping at it. And then the question arose, well, what's the remedy going to be? But of course, because of course, a party going to court doesn't just want to have the judge say, well, yes, you're right, little girl, which is who the plaintiff was in Topeka, Kansas here. But she wants to be given something that's going to vindicate her rights, some kind of what the law calls a remedy. However, it wasn't obvious in Brown versus Board of Education what the remedy should be. In most legal cases in the United States, where the court finds that there's been an injury, the remedy will be implemented immediately. And yet, how could this remedy be implemented? How could a remedy in this case be implemented? You had 17. All are parts of 17 states and the District of Columbia in which schools were segregated. Could the court say, all right, beginning tomorrow, no more segregation, every kid in America has to go to a non-segregated school? How in the world could this be done in rural areas, in remote regions, in big cities? How in the world could this be done? So what the court told the parties was to return the following year and argue the question what the remedies ought to be. So in 1955, we get the court's decision of Brown versus Board of Education, too. There, Felix Frankfurter, who had been long had been known to be the advocate of quote unquote judicial restraint, but actually had been angling with the Justice Department, with various parties, with attorneys in the case to have segregation overturned, thus giving a lie to the idea that he was Mr. Judicial Restraint. He also had the idea that the South would be more apt to accept the court's ruling in this case if there were a slow implementation, if there weren't an abrupt change from their accustomed segregated practice. And so, in Brown versus Board of Education 2, what the court said was that the traditional segregated schools should be eliminated, quote, with all deliberate speed. With all deliberate speed. Now, the question, what speed is deliberate, is of course a matter of taste. For people like Frankfurter, this no doubt had to do with consolidating faculty from the formerly all-black school and the formerly all-white school, deciding which kids would attend which facilities and that kind of thing on a non-segregated basis. But for politicians and parents in the South, notably, all deliberate speed was going to mean never. And what came instead of a happy compliance with this order of the court that the traditional segregated schools be eliminated was what one Southern journalist dubbed massive resistance. Massive resistance was the brainchild of a Richmond, Virginia newspaper editor named James Kilpatrick. And what Kilpatrick had done was to go back and dust off the Virginia resolutions of 1798 and the idea, the Madisonian idea of interposition. And he said essentially what was going on here was that the court had issued an unconstitutional ruling, and it being unconstitutional, it was illegitimate, and therefore Virginia should resist it. And Kilpatrick, in this idea, had the support of the most important politician in Virginia, Harry Flood Byrd, U.S. Senator Harry Flood Byrd, whose Byrd organization was really the Democratic Party of the state of Virginia. So Byrd was the ultimate machine politician running the Virginia Democratic Party, not only at the state level, but at the county level in each county in Virginia as well. And he bought into the idea of massive resistance. Ultimately, massive resistance was going to be tried in several states, and what it meant was that essentially the state governments were going to say, "We are not going to comply with this order. We are going to drag our feet. We are going to put our backs into opposition." More than 100 congressmen from the South signed a document called the Southern Manifesto, which was a brainchild of Senator Daniel from Texas, and also signed by prominent Southern politicians like Strom Thurmond. And what it said was that the holding in Brown versus Board of Education was contrary to Southern tradition. It was contrary to the original understanding of the 14th Amendment. It was contrary to a long line of cases in which the court had upheld the idea, including most notably it's having in Plessy versus Ferguson first enunciated the notion of separate but equal. So these over 100 Southern representatives and senators said, "We're just not going to go along with this." And massive resistance in some of the states meant statewide laws saying that once, if any court ordered that any school had to be desegregated, that is, if you had a white school and a court ordered that a black student had to be admitted to that school, the school would be closed. And if there were too many such orders, all the schools in the state would be closed. In Virginia, ultimately, there was one county in which the local high school was closed for several years, so that ultimately the black students who would have been going to that school didn't have any high school to attend at all for those years. This was a ruinous policy for black people who were involved, but as far as the white politicians were concerned, what was most important was avoiding having non-racialized schooling. And so this massive resistance was their response. They actually tried it in the state universities as well. In 1958, the whole question of massive resistance became international news. In fact, there were statements about it from the news operations in the Soviet Union and various other countries, because what had happened was that the school authorities in Little Rock, Arkansas, decided that the central high school in Little Rock, Arkansas, should be desegregated. And the way that that was going to happen was that 9 black students who had been specifically chosen because of what was thought to be their fitness for attending this formerly all-white school, in other words, people who were thought to have a lot of patience and be willing to put up with a lot of, well, shall we say, hard time they were expecting to be given by the white students at the school, these people were going to be admitted to Little Rock Central High. But once he heard about this, the governor of Arkansas, Orville Faubus, decided he was not going to allow that policy to be implemented while he was governor. And so he ordered that the National Guard be used ultimately to prevent the black students from attending. Well, when he heard about this, the president, Dwight D. Eisenhower, decided to nationalize the National Guard. He also sent in the 101st Airborne Division, famous from its role in conquering Nazi Germany. And those soldiers escorted, ultimately federal authorities escorted the Little Rock Nine school. Faubus became far more popular and actually served several terms as governor of Arkansas as a result of his strict adherence to, again, the traditional idea of segregated primary and secondary schools. And although by 1988 he was in such bad odor with the National Democratic Party that he was not invited to the Michael Dukakis convention, the point is that Southerners at the time were quite enthusiastic about Governor Faubus, even though people in the rest of the country looked on alternately aghast and humiliated by what Arkansas was doing. The Supreme Court took a case about this contretemps in Little Rock called Cooper versus Aaron. And in Cooper versus Aaron, it did something extremely unusual. It issued what's called a per curiam opinion signed by all nine justices. So rather than give the impression that one of them had come up with the court's position and the rest gone along, what the Chief Justice Earl Warren decided to do was to have everyone sign it so that it was obvious that all nine justices were in agreement that it was not the prerogative of state authorities to resist the decision of the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education. And contrary to the statement in the Southern Manifesto that the federal constitution did not give the court power to behave this way, the court said no. Essentially, the court's opinions are the constitution. Here we note a notable break between the prior history of the court and the prior understanding of the different branches' roles in our constitutional system and the system we've lived with since 1958. Before 1958, we have famous episodes such as Andrew Jackson's 1832 bank bill veto message, in which, for example, in that case, Jackson, who had it pointed out to him that the Supreme Court had said in McCulloch versus Maryland, Congress had power to charter a bank, Jackson, in vetoing the law and saying that it was unconstitutional to charter the Second Bank of the United States, argued that it was not his responsibility to enforce the opinions of the Supreme Court, but it was his responsibility to enforce the Constitution. If he disagreed with the court, he had to go with the Constitution, not with the court. There were episodes in which Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson said similar things, but as president, but the court claimed in Cooper versus Aaron that ultimately its decisions amounted to the Constitution. And since 1958, the court has frequently reverted to this position. So, for example, Justice Stephen Breyer recently wrote a book about the way that that he thinks the court should behave, and he takes this for granted, right? First principle is whatever the court says is law, which, as I said, is contrary to the tradition of the United States before Cooper versus Aaron, but is entirely in keeping with the way we expect federal courts to behave today. Ultimately, however, although Brown versus Board of Education 1 and 2 and subsequent events such as what happened in Little Rock got a lot of press, these did not actually bring an end to segregation. Segregation ultimately was going to be ended not by the courts, but by the Congress. The Congress in 1964 took up what came to be known as the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This was a response to the new president, Lyndon Johnson's, call for the Americans to memorialize the slain former president John Kennedy by passing a law that he had favored. Now, Kennedy had actually endorsed this bill, but never really done that much to get it passed, and there was no indication before Kennedy was killed in November 1963 in Dallas that the bill ever would pass. Although Southerners were a pretty small minority in Congress, they had vastly disproportionate influence because of their tendency to re-elect the same people for term after term after term. And so several of the key committee chairmanships were held by Southerners who had done their best to ensure that Kennedy's civil rights bill never passed. But when Johnson came in, within a couple of weeks, he called a joint session of Congress and announced that he intended for the civil rights bill to be President Kennedy's legacy and that he wanted the thing to pass. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 ultimately was adopted at Johnson's urging, and it included several significant provisions. So it was not just about the question of segregation in public, private, and secondary private and secondary schools. Instead, it included titles on, for example, public accommodations, which is to say places to which the public is free to go, such as hotels, restaurants, public transportation. It included a title about employment and a ban on discrimination by race in employment. Because of one senator's apparently joking suggestion, a kind of poison pill suggestion, well, if we're going to have a ban on race segregation, we should ban sex segregation too. When that fellow made that proposal, to his surprise, the Senate adopted it. It was thought that this might help to kill the bill, but instead, when the bill passed, there was this ban on sex discrimination, a first, and not something for which advocates of the bill had been working, but it did include it. And finally, among the most notable provisions was a title about about race discrimination in education. So the 64 Civil Rights Act was going to be one of the chief reasons why segregation ended in the United States. And one interesting sidelight here is the way that the debate in Congress over the Civil Rights Act of 1964 affected people's political loyalties. Since the Civil War, black people had overwhelmingly supported the Republican Party, which was, of course, the party that had freed them from slavery, and the party that, if anybody had opposed Jim Crow, the segregation system, the apartheid system in the South. But although when the 64 Civil Rights Act was voted on in Congress, there were higher portions of Republicans than of Democrats, both in the House and in the Senate, voting for it, the most prominent Republican that year was the party's presidential nominee, Barry Goldwater of Arizona. And Goldwater, a libertarian constitutionalist, thought that the sections of the bill having to do with private property were unconstitutional. So even though he favored an end to segregation, in fact had personally desegregated his family's department stores in Arizona, had personally desegregated the Arizona National Guard, of which he was the commander, he opposed the 64 Civil Rights Act. And this, along with the Kennedy family's intervention when Martin Luther King had been briefly in jail in 1960, seems to account for a wholesale flipping of political allegiances by black people first and ultimately by white Southerners since 1964. Where formerly almost all blacks were Republicans and virtually all white Southerners were Democrats, now it's virtually opposite that. And this must be seen as a kind of jumping off point for this important change. The initiative that finally brought an end to segregation was the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This, according to Michael Klarman, the Harvard professor who wrote a fabulous book on the subject, From Jim Crow to Civil Rights, this, and not Civil Rights Act, not Brown versus Board of Education, is the reason why we don't have segregation in the United States anymore. And in fact, Klarman shows that in Alabama, where in 1954 virtually no white kids had been going to school with black kids and vice versa, in 1964 the same was still true. So it was only the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that yielded a situation in which almost immediately people like Strom Thurmond were asking for black people to vote for them.